Mary Sullivan is my guest this week. Mary undertook a long journey towards finally doing a degree in history and religious studies at the University of Kent, having previously worked as a psychiatric nurse and a social worker. Mary talks about going to Ruskin College in Oxford, which specialised in offering education for working class people. She talks about how the two sides of her degree blended so well. We find out what she might have taken if she'd done a degree when she was younger. We learn that she's quite a political person. We talk about the advantages of finding out about faith through a degree in religious studies, different to one's own. And I ask Mary whether her own perception of herself has changed during the course of her degree. Mary shares her earliest memory from the time that she was in her cot, and she talks about her family's Irish roots. We find out that she has, in recent years, met up with an old childhood friend from Tunbridge Wells. We talk about the notion of stranger danger involving children and how we negotiate the past and fitting in at school and what happened in detention and issues around behaviour and the change in culture over the decades. We talk about how Mary would listen to Radio Luxembourg on her transistor radio and how she became a Beatlemaniac. We find out who her favourite Beatle was and about her passion for Van Morrison. We also find out what the first record was that she ever bought. We find out how Mary has become more politically active as she has gotten older. We talk about the election of New Labour, the concept of the centre ground and her support for Jeremy Corbyn. We also chat about the change in technology over the years and how it has changed the way we engage with family and how we conserve information. Mary talks about how her memories are predominantly positive, about the nature of work post-retirement, what happens when your identity is bound up with your job, and how you deal with life post-divorce. We learn why her younger self would be gobsmacked to find out what she is doing now. Mary obtained her first-class degree, and she tells us how it has made her realise how there is much more to know. And we find out at the very end of the interview why Mary considers herself to be a forward-looking person. It was such a privilege to catch up with Mary Sullivan for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is such a pleasure to have Mary Sullivan here. And of course, until not very long ago, you were an undergraduate here in history and religious studies, and you got your degree literally just a few weeks ago.
Absolutely. I graduated on at 2:30 on the 18th of July.
And how did you feel about that? Because I know you obviously went as a mature student, but this was something you like really wanted to do, isn't it?
Oh, I really wanted to do it. And it was quite a long journey for me. Before I started studying, I had two careers. I trained as a psychiatric nurse, and I also trained as a social worker, and I spent my social work career in mental health. But I retired in 2011, and people asked me what I was going to do when I was retired. And I just used to think to myself, well, how about I don't do anything? That sounds rather nice. I like the idea of that. But quickly, I did want to do things. And my son had studied history, and I was always interested in what his essays were and things. And I thought, I wouldn't mind doing history. So I applied. So I didn't have any A levels. I had some what they used to call O levels. I had five O levels. And in 1966-67, when I left school, five O levels was enough to get you into teachers' training college. It was enough to get you into a good training hospital in London if you wanted to be a nurse. It opened the doors to quite a lot of things, and also to train as a social worker. Although there were lots of graduates who did train, you didn't have to be a graduate. You could get a social work qualification. So I was able to, you know, have professional careers without having a degree or without without having A levels, etc. But anyway, so when I thought I would like to study history, I applied to a college in Oxford called Ruskin College. I don't know whether you've heard of it.
I have heard of that.
Yeah, it's not actually, it's a college of higher education, and it's kind of got an interesting history. It was established in about 1898, 1899, and it was two left-wing American philanthropists who founded it, and their idea was that they wanted to offer education to working class people who hadn't had the opportunity for higher education. And so they offered free accommodation and free education over a period of 2 years, and all being well, if the students passed their exams, they automatically were admitted to Oxford University. That was then. I mean, that doesn't happen now. And it was a way of getting working class people access to not only higher education, but to Oxford University.
Did John Prescott go there?
Yes, John Prescott went there. There are quite a few well-known alumni that went into politics. And it's well-known for being a college that that educates trade unionists, etc., etc. So I did a year there, and I was lucky enough to be one of the last people there that got a free education plus free accommodation and food and everything for a year up in Oxford. I really enjoyed it. And at the end of that, I achieved a certificate of higher education, which I think is stage four.
As it would be called now.
I needed to come back to Kent. You know, I have my family here. So I applied to Kent to do when I looked through the syllabus, because, you know, history was what I was interested in. But when I saw that they had a joint honours in history with religious studies, which is another, my interest, I thought that's the one for me. Yeah. So I applied, but I don't quite know why, but I wasn't offered a place. In the second year, I was offered a place, but it meant I had to start from scratch. But I thought, well, I don't mind. I don't feel that confident that I'm so good it won't do me any harm to do, to start from scratch again. So I think, in September 2014, I started my degree in History with Religious Studies. However, after a term, a very close friend became terminally ill, and I actually became his carer, and he moved into my house, and I realised that I couldn't actually I couldn't deal with the looking after my friend and studying at the same time, so I deferred. And then there was problems when I wanted to come back, because Student Finance England was saying that that I'd used up that bit of funding for that year, but with the help of a very good woman who works at the student union here, I managed to get the funding back. So I started from scratch for the second time in must have been September 2014 to 15. Or was it 15 to 16?
Yeah, because I remember when you first came here, and I think I bumped into you sometimes in the Gulbenkian having a coffee, and then you disappeared for a bit, then you turned up at one of my lectures. And I thought, I remember Mary, and you're actually rather good, if I may say so.
Oh, thank you.
So I thought, I'm glad I didn't know where, now you've told me you filled in the missing years. But I think what worked really well is because you'd often, you got on really well with all the other students. And that was the thing that was really, and they obviously really liked you as well, and that was the thing that really clicked, that you had a different sort of life experience to them, but it all fitted together, and you would do your presentations with them, and it was very much a team effort. And I think that you took it as seriously as they did, and were happy, and worked with them rather than sort of separate, so sort of saying, I've been here, done that, and, I know it all.
Well, I mean, I was terrified, when I came, and actually, believe it or not, I felt like I had stuck out like a sore thumb, amongst the youngsters. But I just thought, I've just got to knuckle down, and because I thought they would all, you know, having just come out of doing their A levels, I thought they'd be absolutely on the ball about everything, and I didn't actually think about what my past experience might bring to it. I mean, it became obvious to me as the time went on that my past experience did have a lot of bearing on stuff, you know, that I was studying,
and certainly the content. But I mean, one thing I remember going to university, and sometimes most of the students certainly were my age, were 18. But those who were much older, on occasions, either because they were aware that they didn't fit in, you know, they wanted to make themselves more distinctive in one way or maybe in terms of the way that they dressed or the way that they talked or who they sat with, who they associated with. And just sometimes there was this sort of sense, they think, well, I've got all this wonderful life experience. But of course, you can have wonderful life experience, but at the end of the day, certainly in those days, you were assessed for how you wrote essays or performed an exam.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, so somebody would say, oh, well, you know, I've been around the world and I've stayed with various, you know, religious communities and I know what it's like from the inside. But of course, that's great, but ultimately you've still got to look at methodologies.
You've it doesn't help you write essays. It might help you with some insights that you might be able to add to your essays somehow, but no, you've got to write essays.
No, I remember having one con- I think I had just started teaching at that point, so it was probably maybe when I was doing either my master's or the PhD, and I was just sitting or talking to a mature student in the student union in Lampeter, where I was. And we had this very conversation that he was sort of saying, oh, well, you know, he has more life experience than me. And I thought, I don't deny that. But I think he was, his sense was, you know, what authority do I have to mark his essays?
What?
And I just thought, and it was interesting, I thought he wasn't a student who completed his degree. And I thought it was just very interesting because it was almost as though he had good reasons perhaps for doing the degree, but there was clearly this binary that was being set up. And I thought the problem is, in a different environment, his life experience would be something that I'd be utterly in awe of and sort of feel, you know, I need your help, and you know, you can help me get from A to B, sort of thing. If I was in a country I'd never been to before, you know, I'm quite sure he would know exactly through his life experience of travelling, etc. But you know, but somehow in a university where it comes down to, well, you know, there are books you have to read and you have to have particular skills that you can assimilate sources. And I think he was saying, oh, I think you're wrong on that. And I just thought, well, no, the sad thing is, you know, it might mean that the degree is a very niche area and not for everyone. And in some cases, maybe it's a bit cut off from, you know, real world. I don't think it is at all, because the skills you learn at university can actually be applied elsewhere. But, you know, but sometimes that kind of, that disconnect is something that certainly didn't happen in your case. But it sounded like you really thrived at it, because the content as well, you know, you were doing a joint honours degree, but you were always sort of drawing on a whole range of different materials.
Oh, well, it was like, you know, history and religious studies, it's like putting on a glove. They just so fit together. And there were times when actually I was kind of confused as to what which discipline I was doing. For example, in what was it, science and religion, that's it. So I wrote a letter on I wrote an essay on Galileo, and it, all of that. I could have been doing a religious studies module, but it in fact was a history one. I mainly, in history, I mainly did focus on late modern rather than early modern. So from Victorian times up until the end of the 20th century. Which always amuses me, because actually I'm old enough to be a primary source for the half of the 20th century at least. But but I did do one early modern history one, which was it was early modern Europe during the during the Reformation and things like that. So
you see, the great thing about a joint honours programme as well is that you can do things that even your lecturers aren't able to do. You can draw all these different threads because you're doing something distinctive and you're doing something that's unique and cross-disciplinary. I guess the worst thing, and it obviously didn't happen in your case, is if anybody has to put on a different hat. It's almost like, oh, the way I write essays for this subject is different to the way I write assignments for the other, to the point that they feel they almost have to inhabit a different mindset. And the ideal joint honours is effectively when you choose what you want to do, and they're all things that you're interested in, but they complement each other rather than that sense of, oh, I'm really, I've got, you know, my one foot in one department, the other in the other.
Like doing, I don't know, physics and history. Or science, and I don't know, I couldn't see how they would...
We have a few sort of like business and philosophy or whatever courses. Okay, but again, you know, very different sort of skills in terms of the assignments or computing, you know, and the what's required of the students is very different in each case. But what a great compliment it sounds like
It was great. And, you know, it made me think, had I... done a degree when I was younger, I don't think I would have chosen history. I remember a lot of my friends and contemporaries at the time were doing social sciences, and I'm so glad I didn't do that, because knowing what how much I enjoy doing, you know, history and religious studies, I just think social sciences would have been tedious and boring.
Yeah, because also, I mean, the great thing was obviously...
You can take that out.
No, that's not libelous. No. But it's funny, actually, because when you're doing a degree... some students in the class obviously are doing it because they want to get a degree and they're doing it for credit and, you know, there may be a job at the end of it.
So,
and that's fine.
Yes, absolutely.
However, and that obviously wasn't you, and it certainly wasn't me. And it came up a few years ago when it was the course I run called Death of God, Modern Theology course. And I said to the student, we're looking at existentialism, and I said, do any of you sort of wake up at 4 in the morning and, you know, we're dealing with meaning of life questions. And I was saying, does anyone sort of wake up and does this sort of really affect you? No one answered. Everyone was sort of looking a bit sort of, you know, shifty. And so I moved on. But I was really trying to get the sense of, you know, are you studying this because it's on the syllabus? Or is there a sense in which this sort of clicks? 2 days later, I got an email from one of the students who, as it happens, went on to Durham to do her PhD. And she said, I didn't put my hand up because nobody else did. But she said, yeah, that would be me. And I thought, that for me was gratifying because it's not for me, you know, everyone has their own rationale for doing what they do. But I also thought that she was having a better quality of experience because for her, going to lectures wasn't just a case of I'm here because I have to. It was here because she wanted to be there. And in a way, you know, that sort of thirst for knowledge, that sort of appetite for finding out things that you didn't know when you went into the classroom, which of course is again different to what you were saying about the hypothetical, for example, mature student who might say, oh, I know it all. It's like, well, if you know it all, what are you doing here?
I definitely didn't have that attitude.
Yeah, no.
Another reason for wanting to do the religious studies side of it as well was because I'm quite a political person, and I've noticed, there's so much goes around about Islamophobia or anti-Semitism, and I was personally brought up as a Catholic, Roman Catholic, from an Irish Catholic family, but I wanted to know about the way other religious, you know, what beliefs people held, and I was hoping, and I think I found that on the whole, whatever your religious faith or none, that there's more in common than there is not, if you know what I mean. I have friends who are atheists. I mean, I'm a bit of a weirdo Christian, I think. But all religious faiths, I mean, they all want peace and love. None of them say that you should go out being horrid to each other or murdering or persecuting each other, although you can find extremes.
Well, that's often the perception of studying religion, because if somebody does religious studies because they want to cultivate a particular worldview that is theirs, then they may be very defensive if, as you say, they're studying another world faith. However, my sense of being certainly at Kent for 15 years and previous jobs as well, and when I was a student, is that there is this willingness and this thirst to want to know rather than the closed mind. I mean, obviously, you know, it may well be that a student starts off as an agnostic or an atheist and they become a theist or a theist and go the opposite direction, but that's not through any effort on my part. In fact, it would be quite contrary to the point of what they're doing in the degree. But that's something that's a journey they would make on their own. But the crucial thing is that they would listen, they would think. I guess sometimes people might choose courses based on what they're partial to.
Yeah.
I mean, if I do have one regret, when I did my degree, which was in theology, I covered very little Islam. And my sense is I came away knowing lots about Christian theology, but my sense was that, you know, when I later on taught as a religious studies lecturer, I kind of felt that I was almost sort of learning about Hinduism, Buddhism, kind of for the first time, really. So, but that, you know, but there's a difference between learning about a particular subject in great detail and being closed-minded about what other subjects have to offer.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. I wanted to find out about, you know, other faiths and other than Christianity. I mean, I had quite a heavy duty Catholic upbringing, you know, Catholic schools, convent schools, etc. So I wanted to know what other people felt and believed, and I wanted to be able to challenge narratives, you know, Islamophobic ones or anti-Semitic ones. I just wanted to, you know, people said things that I could challenge.
And did your perception of yourself change in doing the degree, or indeed did other people's perceptions of you change when you said you were doing the degree in religious studies? Did were there all sorts of assumptions being made that you had to counter?
They seemed to think I was some kind of religious maniac. And I said no, it's when I told them some of the modules I did, I just loved it. I mean, the last module I did with Professor Sho was Sex, Scandal and Blasphemy. I mean, people didn't have it down that you would do something that had that kind of a title, you know. So I think I did change people's perceptions of what religious studies was about. And, you know, that I would specifically wanted to have done religious studies as opposed to theology, because I was aware that actually theology is just around Christianity. And not that I want to dismiss it, but
I mean that's right, because and it was a debate that we often had in terms of the relationship between theology and religious studies, and the way in which you're studying particular traditions, and you're studying, you know, whether you're studying only religions that have a particular mindset that he involves a realist or non-realist perception of God. So you know, and the extent to which you bring theism into it. And I mean, my undergraduate degree felt very wide-ranging, because, you know, we might study the early church, but we'd be looking at lots of politics as well as eschatological beliefs.
It'd be the history.
You know, it was a political history course.
So
I find that you can also mould the degree into whatever it is you need it to be. And, of course, you did, in that sense, a perfect combination. But just going back a little bit, you know, what about things like earliest memories? How far can you go? What do you remember from childhood?
I can't go back really early. I've got a really early memory. It's not much, but I just remember standing in my cot screaming until my father came and took me out of the cot. And then the next earliest memory is I was born in Tunbridge Wells, and I've never used the privilege of writing to a paper saying disgusted of Tunbridge Wells. I still have to use that one. But anyway, so we used to go to my friend Kathy lived opposite me, and my dad and I and Kathy were all in the Calvary Gardens Park, and I remember standing by a tree, and I was able to reach the lowest branch, but Kathy wasn't. I said, that's because I'm 4 and you're still only 3.
Nothing changes, does it, after, you know, I know you've got grandchildren and my children are just the same. It matters hugely what the age gap is between them and who's in charge.
Well, she was actually the same year as me, but I'd actually reached my 4th birthday and she hadn't. So I was born in Tunbridge Wells. My parents, my mother was from County Galway in Ireland, and she was born in 1913, so she would be, how old would she be now then?
106.
106. And my dad came from an Irish Catholic family, but born in Liverpool. My mother's family were peasant farmers, really. She went through all that war of independence as a small child, and she was one of 8, and of course the oldest son inherits the farm and the rest of the family just have to, well, the girls are supposed to get married and any other boys are supposed to find other things to do. But my mother came over to England in the 1930s, to train to be a nurse, as lots of young Irish women did at that time. And the reason for it was that if you had to do your nurse's training in Ireland, you had to pay for it. But if you came to England, you know, you got a small wage and a roof over your head, and you got trained. Yeah. So she did that. And at some point, oh, she was in London partly part of the time when the Blitz was on, because she remember her telling me about it. But she returned to Ireland to look after her older sister, who was dying of tuberculosis. Mm. But then when she returned to England, she went to work in a place called the David Solomons. It was like a convalescent home. I think it's owned by the Trust, you know, the Health Trust now, the NHS. Mm. Or Christchurch, even, it might own it, I'm not sure. But anyway, she was there, and her one of her friends, Joan, was my dad's sister. So they introduced, Auntie Joan introduced my mum to my dad. So when he was demobbed from the Second World War, he came to Tunbridge Wells, and that's how come I got born there.
Yeah. No, it's funny, isn't it? All these circuitous routes and accidental routes and quirks of fate and luck, and you end up... But often it's easy to sometimes think, oh, this is my destiny, or I was, you know, meant to be born in, you know, in order to achieve X, Y, Z. It's almost as though everything falls into place.
Yeah.
But do you sort of... I mean, obviously you're not living that far away now, but did you ever go back to your childhood home?
Yeah, I have done recently, and I found Kathy, you know, the little girl who, I mean, she's had a very different life to me, but it was nice meeting her, and we went walking around the places that, I remember in this Calvary Park Gardens, I don't know whether it's a common thing for children, but we used to wander around it and pretend we were foreign, and we just used to speak gobbledygook right out loud so people would think we were, you know, some sophisticated French people. Really stupid things. And it was lovely to go back and meet her. And Tunbridge Wells was a lovely place to grow up. Where we lived, it was a cul-de-sac, and there was a park called The Grove at one end, and then this Calvary Park Gardens at the other. And then there was the common, where they had rocks that you could climb on, and it was just and I suppose it was the 1950s, and it was just you just, you know, the front door was never locked. You go in the school holidays, you go out in the morning and you wouldn't turn up until dinner time, and then out again in the afternoon, and you just ran wild and free. But
because one thing that's come up in quite a few of the interviews is this notion of stranger danger, whether it was okay to walk to school or go out and play.
We all walked to school
without any fear of your parents thinking that you might be unsafe. But whether that was the case, in terms of your own children, whether there were any different sort of perceptions over the years?
When I had my children, we were living in Canterbury then, and my children were at the Catholic school, St Thomas's, and I think Tom was about 8 when I allowed him to walk to school from London Road. So it was quite a long walk. But, you know, we did the practice run and how he could get there safely. Yeah. But because I kind of thought that that was normal. But I think actually since raising my own children in the... Tom was born in 1979. So in the 80s, I think things have got more danger. Mm. I think there's more perception of that now.
Yeah,
do you think so?
I do, because I remember walking home as well, at least from the bus stop. So when I went back to my hometown, or the part of Cardiff where I grew up, it didn't seem that big a walk at all. But of course, you know, when you're young, 100 yards seems like 100 miles, I suppose. But there was that. And maybe also people didn't drive in the way that they do now in my own children.
Oh, that's true, but not everybody had cars.
Nowadays, because where my children go to school now in one of the villages outside Canterbury, you can only get there by road. There's no bus route. It's a village. And of course, if the weather's awful, if you've got snow, then you can't get to the school.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the parents take their children in the morning and pick them up in the afternoon. There's no alternative. If you lived... lived and worked more in the city than of Canterbury, then I guess, you know, a bus or a walk
to school would be normal.
It's a very 100 pupils.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so they teach the year, well, similar to what we do as with students, of course, you know, put the second and third years together. So they will teach, apart from reception, they will tend to bring the two-year groups together, which was my experience as well, going to a church in Wales, school in Cardiff. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because it's very easy, and this is, of course, the question of nostalgia. Do we sort of go back and remember the happy things? Do we remember, you know, the time when it was safe? And you gave that example of you could leave your door unlocked and nobody would break in. And I wonder whether it really was like that.
Well, of course. Well, I'm, you know, looking back, you want to pick out the happy memories. But, of course, there were unhappy ones as well. I remember being very sensitive when I started school, you know, and I'd come home and tell my mother that everyone was being horrid to me. Yeah. And then occasionally she'd go up to the school and say, what's going on here? Mm. Why is everyone being horrid to my little Mary? Mm. And then the children would get told off and then they would be even more horrid.
Yeah.
I remember that being sensitive and feeling that I didn't fit in and feeling that it took a long time for me to feel that I had a place in the school.
Because when you're young, there is this need, isn't there, to fit in, or people form their cliques, and that's why I am ambivalent sometimes about reunions. Maybe not so much university, but certainly school. Because you've got these cliques. The, you know, people form alliances with students. You know, the sporty ones stay together, and often there is bullying. I witness that, and I think teachers as well, in those days, there was always the risk, and I'm, you know, in my case, I was born in the 70s, and so it was quite commonplace for the threat, if not the actual, you know, the cane, in some cases, if you misbehaved. Whereas these days, of course, I mean, that it's so obvious that that couldn't happen. But again, it's those sort of perceptions, what teachers represented. Because obviously, I work in the education sector. However, when I was at school, it always felt that we were going to school. It felt sometimes though it was a place for discipline. It always felt because the rules, and I was always someone who, you know, what's the right thing to do? And you're always sort of, you know, very observant and respectful. But, you know, you're always aware that there were the naughty children who sat in the back and threw bits of paper in the class and the teacher would go mad at them. But school almost seemed to be sort of a place that you go in order to become responsible and, well, yes, responsible adults.
Yeah.
But it was only sort of towards the end of secondary education, where suddenly it was sort of, you know, but I love this subject, I want to know more about it. And going to university where you could go to a lecture and just enjoy it for its own sake, not worry that behind you people were, you know, writing your name on paper or drawing, you know, silly pictures of you. That was actually quite an interesting step up. And I think that now that so many of my students go into education, go into teaching, I think in many respects, you know, they're going to be so much better teachers in many ways because the culture is so different from the one that I inhabited.
No, I completely agree with you. Mm. I mean, at the convent school that I went to, there was no corporal punishment.
Yeah.
And also they had little boys in, like infants, but after that it was just all girls. But they did have other ways of terrorising you.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't beat you, but you could get detention, and I mean the detentions are all a bit pointless. You had to write lines, 100 lines of "I must not," whatever it was, I had done.
Yeah.
Did you have to write lines?
No. Well, luckily, I can say on this, I was never in detention. But a serious point, though. I mean, what you said is it's like the Breakfast Club. But you're right. I think that did happen. My understanding was, and this is anecdotal, but there was one boy at my school who was very bright, and he must have, whatever he did, he kind of wrong-footed the teacher. Again, this is anecdotal. I don't know if it happened, but he was asked to write an essay or like explaining why he'd been a bad boy when he'd done something wrong. But he wrote this critique of the school and school management. So he did the exercise. He did what he was asked to do. But rather than just sort of say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I won't do it again," he did something that was much more sort of challenging. And I think that
did he get away with it?
All I heard is that the teachers were really annoyed with him. So it was almost as though he was saying, "Well, you've put me in detention, so you've asked me to do an exercise. Well, I'm going to, you know." But this is also the perception, because at university, it doesn't happen so much, but occasionally you do have some of the students who will worry that if they say something that's contrary to what the lecturer thinks or what the lecturer has written, that they may get a bad mark as a result of it. But and that isn't going to happen. But at school, if you wrote something that the teacher didn't seem to agree with, there was always the perception that the teacher would you know, mark you down. Like, you know, even with English sometimes, right answers, wrong answers. And there were teachers who were probably quite old, if I, you know, when I stopped, and they all left by the time of the GCSEs when they were introduced in the late 80s. But where it was a very much sort of black and white, you got, you know, they would tick, if you wrote an assignment, they'd put ticks on next to lines where you said something where there was maybe a factual point or something that showed that you'd listened to something that was said in class, and then they would tot them up and give you a mark out of 10. And it was almost as though you could write a really good essay, but if you didn't have the key words in there that the teacher was looking for, you might get 2.5 out of 10 rather than 9.5 out of 10. And that is a very peculiar way in which to educate. But that was kind of the mindset that seemed to be in place. And again, this is anecdotal because I was one of the first generation of GCSE students.
Right, okay.
But there was that and again, all I'm saying is what people who were perhaps a little bit older than me but had experienced, and why school was in many respects a bit of a turn-off for them.
Well, you know, I wasn't terribly naughty. I was too frightened to be too naughty. But it wasn't hard to fall foul of the rules. I mean, we used to have an assembly every morning, you know, with prayers and hymns, and then we would have to walk in line to our classrooms, and on each corner there'd be a prefect, you know, and if you talked in the line you could get a conduct mark. I don't think that's been really naughty.
And we'd have this, I remember once, and I could understand it because the teachers might assume that if you were talking, you were saying, or in one case, I remember in a history lesson, the teacher shouted at a pupil for writing something, but it turned out they were actually, you know, writing down what she was saying. She said, well, that's okay. She assumed that maybe, you know, they were writing something naughty. But it did arise once where, I remember I was sitting in the front of the class and, you know, I'd said something, but the teacher had heard it, and it was something to do with the syllabus, and it was relevant to what she'd said, and that was okay. But it was almost as though she thought, oh, good, you know, that shows that you're listening and you're asking a sensible question. But there was that fit, and I understand it's classroom management. You've got 30 pupils, some of whom are waiting for the opportunity to misbehave. Then a good teacher is going to have to make sure that everybody is slightly in awe of them in order to get the message across. And then normally they'd relax a little bit. After a few weeks of this, everybody would sort of know what the dynamics were and expected it. And I was always very in awe, really, of those teachers. But also the worry is that somebody who isn't going to misbehave and is there to learn and is there because they have a love of education is almost going to feel then that if they, as you say, you might say ask a question when you're in line to go to one end of the school to the other, and you know, and you get a conduct mark, but actually you're thinking or doing something which is in the spirit of the academic ethos of the syllabus, the program, the course that you're following. So I think education has moved in very more positive directions.
Well, you know, and the other thing is that we had to behave. It was although my parents weren't rich, they were working class. My father was a foreman and in a factory. I mean, he did later develop a career in psychiatric nursing, but at the time he was a foreman in a factory. And my mum did, she was a stay-at-home housewife. That we took in lodgers, that was always interesting. Somehow or another they managed to get the money together to send myself and my sister, they didn't send my brother, but my sister and myself to a convent school which was private, so we had to go on the bus, and if we misbehaved on the bus and it got back to Mother Martha, who was the headmistress, she would say awful things like, if you want to behave like that, you can go to the County Modern down the road. Or she meant the Secondary Modern. We had to behave wherever we were. And, you know, if we took our school hat off or something. Yeah. It was just really strict. And, you know, I can't remember that it was every week. It probably was. There'd be a general assembly where everybody's marks were read out. Yeah. Not your, yeah. You would get, so you would get gold stars, they, you know, on your chart for good work, and silver stars, and then red stars and green stars, all going down to black blobs.
Mm. Yeah, and it's a form of discrimination from today's point of view, because it may, you know, there might be students who don't perform well because they may have a disability, which with these days we would absolutely sort of, you know, it's our job to pick up on those. But I remember in school we had one teacher who would set an exercise where you'd have to remember a poem or a line from a play.
Oh, you had to write them off.
And you'd have
heart.
To stand in... Yeah, exactly. You stand in front of the class and read this out. And if you did it successfully, you could bring games in on the last day. That was the sort of the incentive. Mm. But if you couldn't, I don't know whether this was actually enforced, whether he let everybody in. Mm. But, and of course, these days you look back and say, well, somebody may actually not be able to stand in front of a class and read something out. And it might be because there is a, you know, on perfectly, on good, on medical grounds. And so the idea then that they'd be punished, you know, would be discriminatory, and it would, you know, it's unthinkable that that would happen. But that was, you know, the age of 9 or 10. That was something that was common or garden.
No, I think things have I think, you know, my grandchildren are not terrified of going to school. Yeah. You know, they, the 13-year-old's now, actually he's beginning to change, but he went through the stage of everything's boring.
Mm.
But, you know, not, he doesn't want to go because he's absolutely terrified.
Yeah. But it swings and roundabouts. Yeah. But that also might just be a particular, you know, that's something that will pass. But on the whole, you know, education can be somewhere where you can flourish. And that's the difference from, I never sensed at the age of 9 or 10 that I was going to school to flourish. I was going to school in order to make sure that I conformed and, you know, didn't get a demerit or didn't have to stand in line because you'd, you know, the teachers would bring up at the end of play, they'd blow a whistle. And everyone had to stop. And if you didn't stop immediately, the moment that whistle was blown, of course, you may not have heard the whistle, there could be a hearing issue, then you were told to stand at the front. And of course, then your parents would come, you know, to pick you up from school, and they'd say, oh, you know, and they'd see all the naughty boys and girls standing at the front.
Oh, because it's humiliating,
and looking back,
it?
that feels, you know, abusive, sort of in the way that it was sort of almost sort of, you know, saying that you have to do things in a very particular way or you'll be punished for it, when really that can actually have the opposite. It can make people frightened to go to school and to actually feel that if they don't say anything that's conformist or they don't say anything that's the right answer or what the teacher wants to hear, then you'll be punished for it. And I don't think school should be a place for punishment.
No, but it's made me think, though, you know, my children and my grandchildren and yourself, by the sounds of it, you know, they weren't terribly bad children. They weren't, and you weren't bad. You and the schools were quite strict, but and things have improved. But you know, when you hear about you know, the children with knives in inner city schools and things like that, and then you hear people saying the teachers have got no power to control them because they can't beat them anymore. Well, I wouldn't want them to be beating them anymore, but. But that is rather worrying, isn't it?
Yeah, that's an extremity on the other side, isn't it? Yeah. Actually, then to have teachers in fear, you know, fearing the pupils and you know, for their well being, for their lives.
Because
yeah.
some of them, a couple of them, been actually killed, haven't they, by pupils? I mean, it's not very common, but.
What about other things? When you were at school, I mean, for me, one thing that we did talk about in the playground, and weren't told off for it, was, you know, music. We'd always share what we'd listened to on the radio. I was a real generation of, or my friends were, of radio listeners and music, the charts.
Oh, yes.
Did that impact on you when you were growing up at all?
Well, at some point I can't remember, must have been 11 or 12 or something, when interested in music. Yeah. And, I remember we went on holiday to, we were supposed to be going to Wales, but it fell through. We ended up going to Clacton. But my dad won £25 on the premium bonds or something like that. And he bought a transistor radio. Well, I was completely inseparable from it. And I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg. That's where you could hear all the groovy music. And then I did have two good friends, Susie and Kathy, and we became Beatle maniacs. I think we all liked Paul. I think he had the baby face, didn't he, and the big brown eyes. I remember my friend Susie. I mean, this wasn't so much a music, this was kind of adolescent hero worship, but she won a ticket to go and see the Beatles and meet them, and she got their autographs, and she brought the pen back and she hung it from the ceiling on a piece of rope. Yeah. You know, we weren't allowed to touch it. It was like a relic, a holy relic it was. But yeah, listening to the radio, watching Top of the Pops and Ready Steady Go. I remember the Rolling Stones coming out, and they were much more in the image of bad boys. And the Beatles were, you know, with their awful kind of Beatles suits with no collars.
That's right.
Seemed more clean cut.
But the Beatles, of course, evolved over that decade. It's interesting,
they did,
isn't it? But did you find, I mean, well, first of all, the obvious question, were you a Beatles or a Stones person?
Initially, I was a Beatles person,
But I always, there was
I mean, I prefer the Stones now. But actually, they were very,
absolutely. Because what's interesting is that I think only about a year ago, there was footage of a Beatles concert, and there was like a recording which just had all the screams from the audience. But somebody managed to do something with it, or maybe they found another recording and whatever, and they managed. So, like, for the first time, you can hear what the band were performing
rather than
noise
the screams,
from the audience.
Yeah.
So again, that would have, so when you, as soon as you said going to, you know, your friend had a ticket to go to a Beatles concert, I was thinking how much of the Beatles did she see or hear?
We watched Top of the Pops and the Beatles came on, me and my friend Kathy, and well, if we were sitting watching it in our front room, we'd start screaming.
Yeah.
And my parents just thought we'd all gone mad. Yeah. It was all nonsense.
My parents were also of that generation. Yeah. But when I was growing up in the 80s, that they had no time for that sort of music. So it was always, it was better in my day. They used to wear suits on Top of the Pops.
Yeah. But I remember seeing, I mean, I really do rather like Van Morrison nowadays. I've seen him perform. He's a miserable old git, actually. But his music is I love. But I remember seeing him on, it might have been Ready, Steady, Go, and he was part of a band called Them, I think.
Oh, yes, he was. I'd forgotten that.
And
Here Comes
Gloria.
The Night.
They weren't wearing suits. It was all getting wilder and wilder as the 60s went on. Yeah. People grew their hair.
Very sort of mod era and all that.
I was a mod. Yeah, me and Susie and Kathy were mods.
But what was the first record you ever bought? Can you remember?
Well, yeah, actually, I don't remember buying any Beatles records, but I suppose I must have done. But the one that really sticks out in my mind was not until I was 14 or 15. And by then I was getting a kind of political conscience. My first one that I bought was Freewheeling by Bob Dylan, the album. And around that time, I was really interested in what was going on in the United States, you know, with the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King. And you'd see all these people marching and the terrible things that were going on for black people in the States.
Because political, and it's very clear from, you know, Facebook and so on. But, you know, politics has been a huge part of your life, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And that sort of activism. So does it go all the way back to that sort of era?
Well, I've been more actively political as I've got older, but I had my political views were being formed around that time, I became somewhat of a hippie really as I got into my late teens and early 20s, and the political ideas around then were really kind of a bit anarchic, really. You know, like, we were all hippies and we were going to change the world. There was going to be no more wars. And, you know, but as time went on, you realise that, you know, that hippie generation some of them turned into rich capitalists like Richard Branson, for example, who I wouldn't particularly approve of now. But at the time, you know, everybody was together and it was quite an attractive youth movement for me at the time. Although I think people look back on it and think it was all a bit daft, I don't know.
No, because I remember one mature student when I was in my previous job in West Wales about 18 years ago, who'd done a first degree in the 60s, and she said everybody was an activist. People would go on marches.
Going on marches and things.
And that kind of all stopped, but now it seems to have come back again. Yeah. In the last few years, students are now far more engaged in politics than they were a decade ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember in the 70s going on anti-Nazi league marches, you know, against the National Front. Yeah. And, of course, you know, I remember being outraged at... what's his name? The Rivers of Blood speech.
Oh, Enoch Powell.
Enoch Powell, yeah. Yeah. And and then into the 1970s, going on, anti-racist marches and things like that. And I didn't actually join a political party until the 1980s, when I did join the Labour Party, because I know that there was a lots of disillusionment with Labour politics, you know, after the 70s and the, you know, 3-day week and the strikes and everything. But I think that once we got Maggie Thatcher in, who cancelled the social contract, you know, began the rot we see now with public services, I joined the Labour Party. I didn't really do much. I just was a member. And I remember being really excited when Tony Blair got elected in 1997. But it didn't take many years for me to go off him. And I really think that he did some good things, I suppose. But when Margaret Thatcher was asked about who she thought, what was her greatest success, she said it was Tony Blair.
And I remember reading an interview, or actually it was Chris Mullin, the Labour MP, who wrote in his diary about a conversation with John Major shortly after 97. And Major said what was really funny is that with the huge majority that Tony Blair had, it's funny how cautious he was. That he could have done so much more. Yeah. He had this mandate, and yet he was sticking to the Conservatives' spending plans. So he wanted to show that Labour were a party of fiscal competence.
Yeah, yeah.
But it did almost feel at the time that Labour, we'd waited so long, because I don't remember anything other than a Conservative government until 97.
Well, that's right.
Because
I was
5 going on 6 when Margaret Thatcher was elected.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when Tony Blair came into power, it kind of felt that there was going to be this new world order. And it didn't take long before we realised that somehow it didn't seem to be as radical as the idea of a Labour government was going to be, despite the rhetoric.
Well, it was the middle way, I think he called it. You know, some of the stuff accounts for, you know, the problems that we've got now, like the private finance initiatives, you know, getting private companies to... build hospitals and things, and then, you know, they're forever in debt because that kind of thing. And also, well, the main thing that I had against him was taking us into a war that I consider to be illegal.
Yeah.
I mean, he would always justify it by saying that Saddam Hussein needed taking down, but there's loads of people who need taking down, but it depends on whether they've got oil or not in their countries, so whether we will bother. Yeah.
Yes, no, I mean, issues came up in Zimbabwe some years later. You know, what does it take for there to be this sort of intervention? You know, how bad does a leader have to be in order to, for the rest of the world to say, well, we shouldn't let you govern your own country? But one thing that Tony Blair did say, which always seemed very credible when he said it, was that politics could only be won, you know, elections could only be won from the centre ground.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether that's... I mean, both historically, I'm not so sure about that, because Margaret Thatcher was hardly a centrist politician. And sure, Labour were quite to the left in the 83 election, but she still won with a landslide. So it showed that, if anything, the country was more sort of rightward leaning.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, his sort of big tent, sort of centre-ground politics was something that he was big on. But politics today seems to be far more fractured. And it's impossible to say, you know, and politicians often occupy the centre-ground and seem to be displaced at the moment because their way of doing things seems to perhaps not have achieved as much as...
Well, I'll tell you one thing that kind of upsets me is I'm a supporter of... I'm a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, but having said that, there's no point in making a personality cult out. I mean, he's a human being like any other. But when people say he's dragged the party to the far left, I cannot see it because I cannot see how further left he is than, say, Clement Attlee in the 1940s, who brought us the welfare state and the NHS. I think, well, it's actually... no further left than that. It's you know, it may be going back to what to me would be basic Labour Party principles. But I actually think when they say he's far left, it demonstrates how far to the right the country has actually gone.
And also because a lot of politicians who've led their parties, I think of Ian Duncan Smith, I think of Ed Miliband, they're people who kind of, it was always hard to quite see what their electoral appeal was, and I think that in some cases they were trying to sort of appeal to a wide range of constituency.
I was furious with Ed Miliband, you know, they called him Red Ed, I think, but when he had, you know, these stupid mugs out, you know, tough on immigration and tough on this and austerity light, I'm thinking actually people have had enough of austerity of any kind, and as far as immigration goes, I think that as soon as people are affected by austerity and are really suffering, instead of blaming the right people, they blame the immigrants, you know, the other, they don't see that we actually need immigrants. Well, we especially do now, don't we? Now that we're supposed to be leaving the European Union, whatever the rights and wrongs of Brexit, I just think it's very sad about there being no more free movement. But also, the thing is that the free movement was used as a way of saying that somehow the EU is not racist, but when you look at the way that Fortress Europe and the way that people outside Europe are excluded from it, then you can't say it's not racist. And the other thing that upsets me is, of course, a lot of the people who are becoming refugees have become refugees simply because of our actions in the West of going over and destabilising their countries, you know, Libya and Iraq, etc.
So whereas 10, 15 years ago I was always thinking, you know, what does it take for people to be interested in politics and to vote? Well, now, who'd have thought? But, you know, there are plenty of reasons, and younger people are going out and voting and are far more, and social media, you know, it happened, didn't it, in the 2017 election when the Sun newspaper put out something that said, put Corbyn in the bin, and then immediately on social media there was a retort using the same image that Murdoch's paper had used, which was, you know, put the Sun in the bin. And they were encouraging people to go and put the Sun newspaper in the bin around the country, and people put, you know, showing pictures to say that it happened. So how different from 92 when it was, you know, the Sun what won it over that picture of Neil Kinnock in the light bulb and were the last person to leave the country, switch off the lights.
But social media is an amazing force, really. I was thinking the other day, not just about social media, but just about technology in general, and I was thinking about how, as a child, when we first had a telephone, I used to think, wouldn't it be great if you could see people when you spoke to them? And I thought, well, of course, that'll never happen. And
do you know, actually, I was thinking the same thing, because we used to see these like sci-fi-based programmes at school where there would be... like a big, it was always a massive screen, like a TV, in which somebody would talk to the other person. And it was like, oh, it's like talking to somebody through your TV set, but of course it'll never happen. But nowadays, you know, and it's only within the last decade that, you know, with smartphones, that suddenly you can do that and have crystal clear images, and Skype is another example. But things that we take for granted, but we would have done anything for, you know, telephones were, you know, devices for speaking without being able to see the other person. And so that revolution in technology, of course, good and ill, because it also means that people can disseminate messages and use the internet in order to propagate hate speech, etc. And people can use it irresponsibly. But on the other hand, it can be an amazing force for good, because it means that people, without necessarily having much money, are able to communicate. Well, I guess even, you know, doing this podcast in that sense, you know, do it on a shoestring.
I mean, I just so an example, when we were from the age of seven, we used to go on holiday to Ireland to stay with my mother's brother and his family on the farm. And it was a great long journey. First of all, we used to go on the train to Holyhead and then get on the boat and then arrive in Dunleary, stay overnight with Auntie Bridie, and then get on the train down to Galway the next day. And we'd stay for a fortnight. And when we left, everybody would be standing there in tears because we were going back to England and it was miles and miles away and we wouldn't see each other. And nowadays the world's just shrunk. So you could, you know, I mean, I ring my cousins up. I can see them if I want to.
Because I always thought the world is going to shrink. And because of this, you know, everybody will have the same accent. They'll be almost, of course, the danger there, it's all very corporate and everybody speaks the same, like, the language of the people with all the money. But in many respects, accents, you know, my children speak with, you know, I'm not from this part of the world, but they speak with a slight sort of Kent accent. So in a way, and also you see it with nationalism, and you saw this in Scotland, and you certainly see it in Wales as well, but sort of, you know, movements for independent movement, you know, devolution and independence, hopes and aspirations. And in that sense, that the world may have got, it's both got bigger and smaller almost simultaneously.
Oh, you know, when my son went travelling he went off last December with his partner Helen. They went travelling around South America, and I remember myself going off travelling with my friends. We went hitchhiking around Europe, as one did in those days, and my mother would have to write to me post restante, you know, to some post office somewhere where I'd be going, I remember thinking when Dominic went away how great it was because I could WhatsApp him all the time. And, you know, thank God I was, because, in fact, he got very ill in the last month. He was admitted to hospital in Ecuador with a burst appendix and peritonitis. So that link, you know, you know, the fact that I could speak to his girlfriend and find out what was going on.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Because I remember, because my grandparents were both born in 1920, and they would be talking about telegrams, you know.
Telegrams, yeah.
And, you know, almost to the point that I used to think, do they still have them? You know, and I sort of, you know.
No, do they, though?
Well, I'm going back probably about 30, 40 years when I would have these conversations with them. But yeah, so telegrams, the days before faxes and before emails, I guess they probably did exist.
Oh, yeah, I know, because I remember in the 60s and 70s, if you wanted to, you know, if it was somebody's 21st or a special anniversary, you could send them a telegram, you know, and I did. I remember sending my mother and father a telegram for their 25th wedding anniversary, something like that. But you can't do telegrams now, can you?
No. Well, of course you wouldn't. You wouldn't need to send letters in the same way, because, I used to love writing letters, but I then had to buy the stamps, so I'd have to you know, go to the post office. And when, I remember once actually, by the time I got to the queue, he said, "What do you want?" I said, "Can I have a first class degree, please?" It'll cost you more than 20p. But, you know, and then you'd send it and then you'd post it. But by the time your parents got it, you probably spoke it on the phone two or three times, and then they'd write a letter back. So, you know, it was the ritual of it, I think, more than, you know, if there was important information to be imparted, you'd pick up the telephone.
Well, I think letter writing is, I suppose people do emails, but I think it's not something people do anymore.
Yeah.
I wonder how people's memoirs would be written now. I suppose all their emails would be saved.
No, I've always kept a diary, and I do, you know, where it's relevant, so to do, because obviously email is a huge way, and WhatsApp, I guess, as well. But I'll cut and paste relevant bits in the equivalent of the letters that I still have from when I was a student. A few more philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up, Mary. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you span?
Yes, I think so. Yes, I do. I do. I mean, I have had some hard times in my life. I mean, you know, who hasn't? Mm. You know, if you get to my age and you haven't had some hard times, well, I don't think it's just so just not likely. But I'm really grateful for what I've had in my life. I really am grateful. You know, my parents were good people. They were, you know, they cared about their children. And I remember times, you know, thinking they were awful and I couldn't wait to get away from them. But, you know, looking back on it, they were very good, decent people. And I've had an interesting life. I mean, I always knew I wanted to do something like nursing or social work. And so I was able to do that. I can honestly say that there was never a boring day in my career. That I was able to do... I'm glad that I'm not doing it now, but I was able to do it at a time when you were able to use some creativity about how you approached it. Things have changed since then, and because there's been so many cutbacks to, you know, there aren't so many resources and things. But I enjoyed my career, and I met some great people through it. I'm glad that I had my children. I'm not married now. I'm divorced, but I'm glad that I married my husband, and we are. After a lot of water under the bridge, we are friends now. And so I'm grateful that I have my children and that I've got my grandchildren, and that at this late stage in my life that I've been given the privilege to do this degree.
Yeah.
And now the next thing I want to do is a master's. Yeah. It's really, you know...
So in the same way that you obviously you're proud of your children, but they can be proud of you, and you can do what you, you know, it's so obvious that you took an interest in what they were doing and thought, I wish I could do this myself, and then you did it.
And
they must be over the moon for you.
Well, I think so. I think my oldest son is a bit bewildered. He said, what do you want to do that for? He said, why don't you just enjoy yourself? I said, but I am enjoying myself, you know. It sometimes makes me wonder, had I done a degree, had I done this earlier in my life, you know, when I actually still had a working life to consider, what how it would have altered my choices and what I would have done.
Yeah.
But somehow I don't think it would have done. I think it was meant to be that I did it this way around, because I think...
I think that's also what's at the heart of these interviews as well, that sort of notion, you know, why do you get up in the morning? What is there to look forward to? What's the... Because I'm guessing, I think we had this conversation once, you said that when you were working, you sort of were really, you know, looking forward to retirement in the sense... But then, of course, when you hit retirement, you then think, oh... Right, what happens next? And that's the crucial bit, because it's like, you know, the idea of a holiday, when you had a busy term, you think, oh, I just want to do nothing.
Yeah.
But when you actually do nothing, personally, I feel very lethargic, I feel displaced, I feel that I've lost the momentum
on
a day. So maybe I'm just somebody who likes and needs structure, and other people may function differently. But in that sense, I suppose you can look forward to retirement or finishing a particular job, but often that means that it's the opportunity to then... take up another pursuit. I guess the worst thing that you could do is just say, right, oh, now I've retired, I can just watch TV all day. And, you know, you probably find before long that's not really going to, you know, see you through, two decades.
I was ready to retire. I mean, I think there is a point you reach in doing the kind of work I was doing where you probably feel a bit burnt out. What happened to me with retirement was that when I reached 60, I was one of the last group of women that was able to take the state retirement pension at 60, because it's all, you know, there's the WASPI women now and etc. So I took retirement, but I took something called flexible retirement, which meant that I could take my work pension and my state retirement pension, but still work for the Kent County Council part-time. Mm. So I worked part-time for a while, And the hours were absolutely fabulous. What I did was I worked 2 days 1 week and 3 days the week the week after, but with a 7 day gap in between. Yeah. So it was like I had every other week off. But the thing is that when I'd go back to work, of course, all of my caseload, nobody would have intervened in the meantime unless something, you know, dire had happened. And I used to come back with, everybody making demands on me. And I remember I went on holiday to see my sister who lives in France. And I went on a long holiday. I was away about 3 weeks and I kept thinking, I don't want to go back to work. And anyway, I went back to work on a Monday and it was a team meeting and they said, we've got three more clients for allocation, Mary. So I just said, oh no, I said, I couldn't possibly take them on because I'm retiring. Yeah. So I just, it was absolutely came out of my mouth. And so I had to give 3 months' notice. And I did worry, I thought, because it wasn't just how I would cope on a lower income. It was also the realisation that my identity was completely tied up in my job and my status as a social worker. What would I be if I wasn't a social worker? Yeah. But anyway, I haven't really looked back. My period of retirement has just been great.
Yeah. Because I suppose related to that, you know, that whole question of whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences because of the way that we look at the past and imagine all sorts of alternative scenarios, or we gloss over the things that weren't so good and say, but you know, it worked out okay in the end. But does that sort of work in your case?
Yeah, I think so. When I set out in life as a young adult, I thought that I would have a career, meet a nice man who I'd get married and live happily ever after with, have children, everything would be... But it didn't turn out like that. I mean, my marriage didn't work out, and that was obviously a difficult time. But what's the point? I think once I gave up the notion of being the princess who didn't live happily ever after, I've just gone from strength to strength.
No, and somebody once said to me that if you can't reach your aspirations, or if your goals are making you disappointed because you can't realise them, we'll just create a new set of goals and make them a bit more attainable. So you're not going to be disappointed all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I am looking back with rose-tinted glasses, but I certainly have had difficult periods in my life. Yeah. But, at this stage, I'm just grateful that I've survived this long and that I've been given lots of opportunities.
And what do you think your younger self would think about what you're doing now? You know, that whole question about whether you fulfilled the dreams
you had. I think my younger self would be absolutely stunned, really, because when I was at school, I didn't pass my 11 plus, and that was a bit, you know, at that time, there still is in Kent, the Kent test, but so I didn't go to a grammar school. I felt a bit of a failure, really. I knew I wasn't stupid. I never thought that, you know, I never had it in my head that I was stupid, but I just wasn't good enough for grammar school. And so university was for other people. Yeah. University wasn't something that it ever occurred to me that I had the ability to do. So my younger self would be stunned. Not only that, but is it all right if I boast now? Because I got a first class honours degree. And
but if you hadn't said it, I would have done it.
I'll
take the credit for it. No.
Half of it.
Yes, you can,
Chris, because you were one of the people that taught me so well that I managed to...
Yeah, you can definitely say that. And I'll make sure that comes
out. Yes, that bit goes in. But my younger self would be gobsmacked, I think, that I'd done that. So I'm very proud of myself at the moment. I haven't quite got over myself yet.
No, I think your trajectory is not... No, that's the wrong word for a trajectory, I think, in this case, because it's been... Because in a way, it's been a cumulative process.
Yeah.
You did it, and the great thing is that having got it, you know, no one's taking it away from you. Whatever you do or don't do, you've got that. Yeah, it's an achievement, and it's a record of achievement. It's a piece of paper, but it's also, and with, you know, all the work that you put in, all the assignments you produced, all the lectures you attended, but also the journey that you've been on, and almost that validation, that vindication that this
brilliant.
Was the right thing to do, and that it wasn't uh, a a crazy dream to have. No, it was something that actually did.
It came true. Yeah. And, well, but I just to say on a more humble note is that having got my first class honours degree, is that actually my younger self would have thought that to get that degree must mean that actually I know an awful lot. But actually what it's made me realise is how little I know and how much more there is to.
People who go in to do a degree in religious studies and think that they know what religion is because that's why they're studying it.
Yeah.
But then they realise that what they know of religion is just their particular perspective or way in.
Yeah.
And then they encounter all these scholarly perceptions, which may or may not dovetail with what they thought. And then that's when you really start to get to know your subject.
So I feel humbled by what I don't know, but I do feel very proud of myself that I managed to get, to get my degree.
Absolutely.
So,
and just two more questions: are you in touch with friends from your past? Not either in Tunbridge Wells or at Ruskin.
Ruskin, I'm in touch with one of my history lecturers, Dr. Walker. He's just on Facebook, and a couple of friends on from Ruskin on Facebook, but a lot of them have kind of gone on their different paths now, and also Ruskin is changing, sadly not for the best. I don't know whether there's been all sorts of stuff going on with the UCU. They've got rid of quite a few of their degree courses. The thing is that they're College of Further Ed, and most of those have been turned into universities. But Ruskin had a unique perspective because it would take you. I mean, I didn't have nothing. I had 5 GCEs and 2 professional qualifications, plus others. But no degree, but lots of people who went there had all kinds of disabilities and got thrown out of school or it was a second chance for them. So it hasn't got university status, and I'm not sure it'll last that much longer, which is kind of sad.
No, a lot of institutions are going that same way. It is, particularly when there's all that investment, emotional investment in a place, and it's sad to see its ethos, not continue to thrive.
Well, yes, because it was a way. It was just a way for people who never thought they could do it to be given the confidence to do it. I mean, I think I was very fortunate compared to some of the people that went to Ruskin. Yeah. I had had somewhat of an education, through being trained as a social worker and as a nurse. But one of the things that did, I think, help me was that because my main career really was social work, but once you've qualified, that's not the end of it. Each year you have to update your, your professional knowledge base, and you have to keep on writing.
Yeah.
And of course, I had to write a lot of reports, so I had to be able to. Express myself on paper, and although report writing is not the same as essay writing, I could string a sentence together, and I think that helped.
And my very last question, Mary, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm looking forward again now because I'm working out how I can fund a master's. Because I can't screw any more money out of Student Finance England. Because although they gave me shed loads of it to do, my first degree, if you're over 60, they won't lend you any more money. Ageism, I call it. So I'm looking forward to doing that. And I'm also looking forward to, because I've been utterly, utterly focused on studying. So I'm beginning to look outside of that as well, because I don't want to do the master's this year. I want to, get back into the world, as it were, a bit, and then go back next year. But, I'm getting on. There's a limit to how much I can do. But
it sounds like you've got bags of energy and you're not going anywhere yet. It sounds as though you're completely driven. And you're just keep whatever you're doing, keep going.
Thank you.
Mary, it's been so wonderful to catch up this afternoon, and congratulations again. I'm going to mention it this time on your wonderful degree achievement.
Okay. Oh, thank you.